And today is day four on the Radio Cafe of the KSFR Fun Drive. And it's been not a bad week here on the Fun Drive, but it's also been a little bit slow, and we really don't want to go into next week for the Fun Drive. So what we're going to do today is we're going to set our goal at $1,000 or more. We would like to break $1,000 by as much as we possibly can. And we would also like every single person who is calling, who listens to this show on a regular basis, to give a call, 428-1393, 428-1393, and support the Radio Cafe. I have here with me in the cafe, Zaylee Pollan. She is the co-news director of KSFR, along with David Marish. Both of them are brand new at the news department, and she has been host of the Santa Fe Radio Cafe on many occasions. Welcome.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here. So you have been a public radio participant and fan for many years. Why do you think people should support this station and this show right now?
Well, I should say from the back of you, Hattie, you had often asked me to come and be able to substitute for you. And it was so intimidating because you are such a phenomenal interviewer. You know so much about so many things, and this show is incredibly varied. I think it just offers people this expansive exploration of so many different topics, and you do it so well, in depth. And so being able to step in and kind of sit in for you this summer and experience that, not only to be able to choose from this incredible variety of topics, but also to be able to really explore them in depth. And as a print journalist, I've said this many times, I had lost that opportunity. And this public radio is the way to do it. So 428-1393, it's such a valuable asset for this community to be able to really hear about everything going on here and nationally.
428-1393 is the number. We're going to hear an interview that I recorded down at the KSFR studio yesterday by an author named David Stewart McLean, talking about, it's a memoir of amnesia, so he's talking about this time when, for reasons that you're about to hear, he completely lost his memory. His memory was completely erased, and it's a fascinating book, and when I was at the KSFR studio yesterday, I said to Zaylee, Zaylee, I've read this amazing book and just interviewed this guy today, and you said, and Zaylee said, oh, let me take a look at it. What happened?
Well, so I go home last night, and I think, okay, let me just review it a little bit so I can talk about it in the morning. At 9 o'clock, I could not close it until midnight when I had finished the entire book. This does not happen to me. I always tease Mary Charlotte that she's the one who reads all the books the night over, but it's a fantastic, fantastic read for so many reasons that we'll touch upon afterwards. But once again, just providing you with such incredibly interesting information on this show. I was thrilled to read the book.
405-428-1393, and we're going to go to the interview now by David Stewart McLean. We have only 5 copies of this book available, and so the first 5 people who make a contribution of $75 can get a copy of this book. David Stewart McLean is also speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. And so when those 5 copies go, people can go down there. Supporting your local independent bookstore and supporting your local independent radio station are connected.
Absolutely. People, please go. Yes, absolutely. Support Dorothy down at Collected Works and this program, KSFR 428-1393.
So let's now hear David Stewart McLean.
I'm delighted now to welcome David Stewart McLean. He's author of the book, The Answer to the Riddle is Me, a memoir of amnesia, and he will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe tonight at 6 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So at the beginning of this rather amazing book, we meet you. You are waking up, standing in a train station in India, having no idea who you are, where you live, or anything else. What happened next?
You know, for this brief moment when I woke up, and if you haven't been to an Indian railway station recently, there's a lot of chaos because people are rushing into the train and people are rushing out, and there's just so much stuff going on. And in this brief moment when I first woke up, it was sort of just data. It was just all this sort of sensory data that I had, but I had no narrative, no context to be able to sort that data. And so I think about that a lot, that how much of our narrative, our life narrative, is just a way for us to make a hierarchy of data. And so for a while, it was actually just sort of like my brain had been dilated and I was just swallowing all the world's data. And it wasn't until I realized that I needed to do something next that I started to freak out. Because in order to do something next, I needed to know what I was going to do. And if I didn't have the information of who I was, I had no idea what I was going to do. That's when I started to panic, and that's when I started to get terrified. And luckily, a tourist police officer named Rajesh came and found me and told me that he was used to finding foreigners like me on drugs on his platform and that he was going to take care of me.
And in the subsequent days, first you were taken to the home of somebody who dealt with foreigners who had taken too many drugs and were out of it, and then you were put in a mental hospital. This is all in Hyderabad, India. And it was determined that you were having an allergic reaction to an anti-malaria drug called Larium, which has been called, as you write, the Agent Orange of our time. What were the effects of that drug on you at that time and in the years that followed?
So what it turns out is that when I first got the test back, my blood tests and my MRIs and stuff, the allergic reaction was just a working theory. And it turns out that's not true. It's not an allergic reaction. Instead, it's a known side effect of the drug, which is kind of intense to think that that's a known side effect of the drug. Suicide is a known side effect of the drug. Depression, anxiety, paranoia, and confusion, all side effects of the drug, as well as vestibular side effects such as vertigo, tinnitus. And so, like, the brain, if you're the specific kind of person that the mefloquine Larium can pass through the blood-brain barrier and pool in your brain, it works as this potent neurotoxin and just kills brain cells.
And so the effects of that, in your case, were very intense. Can you describe them?
I had intense hallucinations. I had amnesia, but it wasn't sort of a constant amnesia. What it was like my brain was spasming. And there would be times where I'd remember things, and times where I wouldn't remember anything, and times where I'd remember everything, and times where it would all be gone. And that's sort of why I chose to write the book like I did, that there are parts of the book where it seems like I know things and parts of the book where I'm just lost. And that's sort of really important for me to get at that exact truth of how that experience felt, which is it was almost worse than just Fred Flintstone amnesia, because the moments when I did have something come back to me, I didn't know how long I'd have it before I'd lose it again.
Did you have the intense need to write it down when you did remember?
When I first woke up in the asylum, I thought I was being given a pop quiz by God, and I thought the whole world was giving me clues, and so I would draw all over the newspaper and try to make connections in the newspaper as if newspapers were a coded source that were seeking to send me messages on what the thing was. And so when I get to my apartment later and I find all of my books, and in all of the books I have, there are footnotes, there's marginalia, so it seems like I'm always a person who's trying to break down and figure out what's going on.
It's interesting that when you were talking earlier about, I mean, you were in the train station and there was all this data coming in and you're trying to make sense of it. And then you have the newspaper and you feel like it's trying to tell you something. There's a really striking passage to me in the book, and I'm going to quote from that. You said it's a bit later in your story, but you wrote, "As long as there was chaos, I was okay. It was when everything congealed into a meaning-making machine producing feelings of unity within the world. If a moment like that came, then I should be worried." Explain what you mean by that and what that experience was like.
So at one point I had these auditory hallucinations of music. I had this music going, and everybody in the world around me, and this included like the ambulance men, these two gentlemen who came to help me in the guest house and the nurses, everybody seemed choreographed by the music, and everything they did was part of the music, and that was terrifying. It was terrifying that there was this song that was uniting the world, and that's when I realized, oh, this is what craziness is. This is legitimate craziness. Chaos, in some ways, is safer than everything making sense. When everything makes sense, that's when I get worried, because it means that some sort of intense hallucination is over-ordering the world.
It's funny, because sometimes people seek out some of the experiences that you had on purpose. Like, they'll put on Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon, and The Wizard of Oz at the same time, and they go together. Or they'll seek out, through meditation, things like, well, an experience that you had, which was becoming one with the universe, becoming one with everything around you. But in your case, it was not a good experience at all, on the contrary.
Right. It felt like I was sloshing out into the world, that I was just sort of, I was dissolving into the world, and that wasn't a pleasant experience. Because in some ways, like, I needed the container of me to hold whatever that was. And if the container of me failed, then I was gone. And sometimes people in those aspirational states, the people who want to experience that state, call it an ego death. And that's sort of what it felt like. I was able to see myself objectively. I was able to experience myself without myself getting in the way, which seems needlessly complicated. But that is sort of the way it felt.
We're talking to David Stewart McLean about his memoir, The Answer to the Riddle Is Me, a memoir of amnesia.
And we are here at the Santa Fe Baking Company listening to this guy. I just did this interview yesterday, and listening to it again, it's still interesting to me. If you want a copy of this book, call 428-1393, 428-1393. And, you know, it's quite interesting, but we are 0% of the way to our $1,000 goal.
As far as we know here. So, people, please call in. And the thing about this story that is so extraordinary and remarkable is that anybody who's traveled kind of has a sense of what it's like, especially if you travel to any kind of malaria-prone countries, which is fairly fairly common at this point. So it's incredibly interesting, and I think that's what you do on your show most of the time, is find ways to connect people to their own experiences. And these ideas of identity and how we kind of redefine ourselves is part of what makes this book and this author so incredible.
If you like what you're listening to, if you like this interview and this show, please support it. Listener-supported public radio, and we talk about this every 6 months, is radio that's supported by listeners. Who is the listener? It is actually you out there in the world of radio signal, whether it be virtual digital signal and you're streaming KSFR.org, or whether it be right now you're listening in the broadcast area somewhere in northern New Mexico to KSFR. Listener supported means you support it. So give us a call, please, and support this show and this station, because basically we can't stay on the air without listener support. It's really a pretty simple equation. 428-1393.
And publicly funded radio, too. I mean, it's rare. And I was saying this yesterday on the air as well. We're kind of like a dying breed to have this kind of non-advertising radio. And it's such an incredible value. I mean, listening to this show every morning, listening to the news, listening to jazz. I mean, the more I hear about the various shows on KSFR, the more I see how unique and extraordinary it is. And it is a service to you. We do this for you, the listeners. So call now, 428-1393. Believe me, Mary Charlotte has the most extraordinary fan club. And if people have not donated yet, today is your day. Call 428-1393.
We've got a $1,000 plus goal for this hour. We'd like to exceed $1,000 this hour. And it would be just awesome if every one of you would participate in that. It's funny that you use the words a dying breed, because I think it's actually the opposite. I think that little by little, people have gotten sick of media consolidation. They've gotten sick of the kind of cookie cutter, you know, you go from one station to another, you go from one town to another, and it all sounds the same. I have noticed that the two, for example, corporate chain bookstores that were in Santa Fe have both closed, whereas the public radio station, I mean the public, the independent bookstores have all stayed open, and they're doing well. It's not easy, but it's the same thing. This public radio station, I think, is one of the more popular stations in the city, if not the most popular station in the city.
Absolutely, but it's because of everybody's support, too, saying this is the kind of programming that we want. And it is incredibly valuable, and I think people don't get to see that until they see what the other options are. And then they realize the same thing with bookstores. I mean, how wonderful that we have these independently owned bookstores here in Santa Fe. Thank God they still exist, and we need to support them and this radio station.
And there's a bunch of them. New books, used books, some of both, spiritual books, variety. I mean, it is quite extraordinary. One thing that you don't want to do is make me sing Joni Mitchell, "Don't It Always Seem to Go That You Don't Know What You Got Till It's Gone." Because among my various small number of talents, singing is not among them.
And I could join with some yodeling, and then we'd really go over the edge. So
428-1393 is the number. If you call now, you will be supporting this book, this show, this town, this station, and it really is worth it. I don't know how else to make you see that you, the listener, is who we're talking to. I think a lot of people who are listening right now, they say, oh, they're not talking to me, they're talking to somebody else. We're actually talking to you. All the people out there who are listening right now, and all the people who have said to me at one time or another, Mary Charlotte, I really like your show. Well, you know, thank you. And I really, truly, from the bottom of my heart, thank the people who have said that over the years. It makes a huge difference to me. And it keeps me going. I mean, as we've talked about many times, nobody here is doing this work to get rich or to buy a fancy house or any of that stuff. We're doing it because we love it, we think it's important, we're good at it, and we see that it's a service to the community.
And everybody should call right now, 428-1393. I mean, try to imagine your morning and your day without the Mary Charlotte Show. Imagine going through your day without KSFR, without a new news hour, without the BBC that actually tells you about international news event. Just try to picture your day without it and realize what a value this is. I think that a lot of people, like you say, think, well, you know, I'll donate later, or I've done my small donation. I mean, think about donating more. Think about becoming a sustaining member. And then, actually, you don't have to think about it. It will be ongoing until you ask to stop. So there, you make a donation every single month to support our operating expenses. And the point is that it does cost money to provide the service to you. It costs money to do these interviews, to put in the time, to train people, to provide really top-quality shows without advertising.
And it doesn't cost a whole lot, which is also a beautiful part of the point, because if you come on the phone right now, if you call right now and make a contribution of $10 a month, or you make a contribution of $15 total, every bit actually makes a difference. So 428-1393, and apparently the phones are ringing. I'm getting messages from the control room that we've got people on the phone. Let's keep them ringing. And if you want to get, we've only got 5 copies of this book. It is so good. No, everybody should read it. I mean, who's interested in this kind of thing, which is a lot of people, I think, should read this book, whether you get it right now on the phone or whether you go to Collective Works Bookstore tonight. 428-1393. Let's go back now to David.
So you began to piece together the facts of your life. You would look at photographs of family and friends. There were photographs of yourself with various girlfriends. You didn't know who they were. You didn't know what their names were, what your relationship was. But almost like a journalist, you started to recover that information. Did you recover the memories really with them, or was it more like a journalistic reconstruction of your life?
I think it's both of those. Sometimes I feel like I've recovered the memories, and sometimes the stories I've constructed about the photographs are in some ways more real than any memory I might have had. And I'm not sure it's that different from the way other people look at photographs. I think photographs become their own sort of myth, their own sort of legend in our lives outside of the moment itself. what I tried to do when I was looking at those photographs was sort of using the character of me, the character that I was learning about all the time from my parents, from my sisters, from friends. I tried to construct the scene in which this character of me was participating. And sometimes that would evoke a memory, and sometimes the story was enough, and I was able to just say, now I know what I was doing in that parking lot with that woman with the remarkable nose.
And there's a kind of interesting honesty that came from that. There was a girlfriend that you had, and you looked at your pictures with her, and you said, well, I don't know exactly who she is, but I don't think I really like her that much because I seem to be distant and looking away in the pictures of her. And I thought there's a kind of honesty and basically kind of rational looking at the facts without your emotion for this person getting in the way of knowing what the reality was. That was kind of poignant and interesting.
Yeah, I was able to see that in a lot of pictures I had with this specific person, I was always looking away. I was looking out of the frame. And I was able to say, you know, maybe this isn't good for either of us. And she is. She is the only person who came to visit me when I was in Ohio, when I was recovering. She's this remarkable person. But in some ways, I could tell objectively that the relationship wasn't going to work out.
Now, the part of the book in which you describe those early days after you woke up and then you went back to Ohio with your parents, it's very visual, very sensory writing. Were your senses heightened when you lost the informational part of your mind?
Yeah, sometimes I think about it, and excuse me if I'm nerding out a little bit too much, but I think about it like Matt Murdock, who's Daredevil in Marvel Comics, and he lost his vision, you know, by being hit by a radioactive isotope, as that happens in comics. But all of his other senses were sort of heightened. And in some ways, that's the way it felt. It felt like I was sort of super sensory engaged in the world. When you don't have a narrative context, you don't know how to sort that data. And so any data can be the most important data. The birds on the windowsill can be incredibly important data. Anything. And India is full of data. And so it was a lot of me not knowing which data to put faith in.
As you got your memory and your kind of cognitive faculties back, did that recede?
Yeah, without a doubt. It's one of the things that I find really interesting is how much of daily life we treat like triage, that we just have our errands. And we have these things that we need, and we sort of, our brain sort of eliminates all of the data that doesn't correspond to those errands, those chores, those whatever, those immediate needs, when there's so much more data out there. And that sort of fascinates me, is how much data am I missing when I go to Walmart to buy a bag of Cheetos, and I just only see Cheeto information.
And it's funny, too, because I think we filter out a lot of ugliness on purpose. For example, if you live in a kind of horrible, filthy, noisy city, your mind filters that out on purpose. But then when you go to places, if those filters are still on that are beautiful, it's that much harder to see them and take them in.
Yeah. Because you still have those. It's funny because when you live for a long time in a place where everybody speaks a language that you don't, and then you fly back and you end up in the Detroit airport, like, suddenly everything's so loud because all of your ear filters have been removed. Because when you're in a country where everybody's speaking a language you don't understand, you stop, you just hear everything as noise. You hear everything as just sonic data that can mean something, cannot mean something. You just sort of open your ears more. And then as soon as you get to the Detroit International Airport, you immediately have to reconstruct those filters.
Very interesting. Now, there are some horrifying stories about therapists who didn't listen to you. Tell us some of those stories. I mean, one of them was responsible for sending you back to India, where you were a Fulbright scholar, who really didn't listen to virtually anything you said about your mental state.
Yeah, in some ways, I feel like he was doing his job, which was to fill out a form, and that's what he was asked to do, is to fill out a form, and I thought we were actually having a conversation, but he was actually just filling out a form to say it's okay for me to go back. And what everybody thought, you know, to be charitable, everybody thought that it was like food poisoning, that once I had the drug out of my system, that I would be fine. And they didn't realize that, as we now know, like, larium has this incredible half-life that can stay in the brain for up to and over a decade. The other theory is that it's just a neurotoxin. It just kills brain cells, and so you no longer have those parts of your brain. So, like, for this guy, he just was looking at a form that he had to fill out, and the fact that I was crying and losing it in his office didn't mean anything in terms of the form he was filling out. He just wanted to make sure I was mentally competent to go back to India, not emotionally competent.
Do you think you were?
What I did in order to go back to India was, you know, I'd woken up and I'd been told I was a drug addict, and then I was taken to a woman's house where she told me that I was breaking my mother's heart by doing drugs, all of which wasn't true, but to them it was true, and to me it was true at that moment. And so I felt, when I woke up in the asylum, like the biggest failure in the world. I felt haunted by failure in the way that when you walk through a spider web, even when you wipe it off of your face, you can still feel it on your face.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt this tremendous failure. And so I didn't want to lose this fellowship. And so I did whatever I had to do, including telling everybody I was okay, in order to go back. In the long run, it turns out that was the most brilliant, stupid decision I've ever made in my life.
What do you mean?
If I had stayed in Ohio, I would have been confronted every day with things that I didn't know, but should know. Like, I couldn't go to the grocery store across the street without bumping into people who knew me, and I would feel that absence every time I would go over there. But in India, especially in the Tarnaka section of Secunderabad, where I was living, I didn't know anything, and nobody expected me to know anything. In fact, people went out of their way to tell the blonde guy in Secunderabad that I knew nothing. And that was sort of freeing, because then I could just concentrate on rebuilding my personality, rebuilding a lot of foundational stuff. If I stayed in Central Ohio, I'm convinced I would have killed myself, because I would have just become so depressed at being a failure.
I mean, I think it's also fascinating, and in a way, it's kind of, I imagine, a kind of adaptive trait that we have as human beings or as human animals, that you don't really want people to see how bad off you are, how much you're suffering, and the people around you who had preconceived ideas of who you were really didn't lose those ideas and therefore didn't really see you. And meanwhile, you had learned to compensate and to pretend and to learn what it looks like when people recognize you so that you can pretend that you recognize them. And at the same time, on some level, you so longed to be seen for the vulnerable state you were in and to be taken care of.
Yeah. Yeah, I sort of just wish someone else would take care of me for a long time, because it was terrifying. I thought it was ridiculous that my parents would let me drive a car. I couldn't understand that they didn't know how bad off I was, but I was also telling them I was fine at the same time, because I definitely didn't want to go back to the asylum, but I also didn't have the language to talk about it, to talk about what was going on with me. And I think it's also, you know, when you're not well, you become a chore and an errand for all those people around you, and that becomes tiring for a person. And so you sometimes just want to be okay so they can stop worrying. And I wanted my parents to stop worrying. I wanted them to feel like I was okay. And so I told them I was okay. My parents and I have talked about this often, and if I was 18, they would never have let me go back to India. But since I was 28 and an adult, there was just a default assumption of competence, and so they just thought I was in my right mind.
We're talking to David Stewart McLean about his memoir, The Answer to the Riddle is Me, a memoir of amnesia.
And we are in the Santa Fe Baking Company, and we actually have had some callers, and we are on our way to our $1,000 plus goal. We want to not just reach it, but really exceed it during this hour. I think there's one book left.
That's right.
Okay, and the book is for a contribution of $75. It will be sent to you, lady or gentleman, that one lucky listener who can get that book. 428-1393 is the number. 428-1393, and we've got some thank yous.
Indeed we do. Nancy Zeckendorf.
Thank you.
In total honor of you, Mary Charlotte.
Well, and in honor of you too, Nancy, thank you.
And Lorraine Gilmore.
Thank you.
And Andrea Terry.
Thank you.
Nancy Warren.
Yay.
Nora Fisher.
Thanks.
Sharon Wolf Timon gets up every morning just to hear you. Well, not just to hear you, but she makes it a point to hear you.
Presumably she's getting up for other reasons.
Maybe not. I know a lot of people who get up just for you.
Well, Nancy Warren, who kindly made a contribution, is a photographer who lost her vision. And she came on the show once to talk about a work of a book that she was publishing of works that she'd done before she lost her vision. And she told me that this show helped her get out of a depression that she was in when she lost her sight. Mm. So, Nancy, big hugs to you and to everybody. Okay,
yes, and
back to thank you.
We have Linda Dixon.
Linda, thank you.
Richard Olson.
Yay.
And, of course, Anonymi.
Yes, the big family of Anonymous that are have been around since before the Renaissance and make lots of good art. 428-1393.
And I wanted to add, too, you had mentioned that this book would be great for people who enjoy the topic, but, you know, it's incredibly well written.
I mean, it's
just a fun read. And there's a New Mexico connection, because this man went to, down in Las Cruces, is that the New Mexico State University?
Yeah, he went to the university.
And he actually thanks people, Robert Boswell and his wife, Antonia Nelson, and these are people who I know have inspired many other New Mexico writers as well. So I actually loved that connection. So he refers back to New Mexico a lot, and it's part of him rebuilding his memory. So that kind of connection is so potent, and the story is so extraordinary. Again, for anyone who's traveled, anyone who's dealt with drugs, or anyone who kind of understands the way that the FDA kind of sends out these drugs, you know, they say, okay, well, it might work for that without knowing any of the side effects, you know, the way we use pesticides without knowing any of the side effects. And I think this is a much bigger story about the way that this country and this world uses these kind of chemicals without knowing what happens there.
Yeah, and the pressure from drug companies to approve a drug. And, all the books are gone. The phone is ringing.
All right.
But you can still get a copy of the book, as we said, by going to Collected Works bookstore tonight or anytime. Lots of different ways to get the book, and there's lots of different ways to pledge to KSFR, but the main one is calling 428-1393.
And if you're out of the calling area, 866-907-5737. You can also go online. But call and call now. Call during this hour so we can make that $1,000. That would be fantastic. And please be sure, even if you cannot get a book here, that you go down and listen to this author. This book is fantastic. The story is absolutely amazing about the way we create our identity and rebuild our memory. His story is so wonderful, and his writing is fantastic. So call now, 428-1393.
And it looks like, do we have a book left? No, we don't. Okay.
tonight, go down, Collected Works.
But the main thing is to call now. But yeah, what you were saying about how drugs get approved, the pressure to approve them, I don't know any other way to say it, but sloppiness of the clinical trials. I mean, as he describes in the book, they tried this drug out on Peace Corps volunteers, and a bunch of them had hallucinations, and they just chalked it up to stress.
And he mentions a number of soldiers coming back from Afghanistan areas in Afghanistan and Iraq where they had had to do this. And he, you know, we don't know what all of these incredible spates of domestic violence are about, whether it's PTSD, whether it is the effect of Larium, but he makes it sound as if that is a very likely cause, that you literally go crazy. So they actually know the effects of this, and they still knowingly send it out. I actually had a friend who was driving down through South America. We had a lot of discussions about Larium before he left, and we knew a lot of this. This was, you know, maybe 10 years ago. And I ended up getting this totally freaked out, paranoid call from, you know, somewhere in Peru, and we had to go online, Google. He was calling from some little cafe, and he was sure he was dying of malaria, even though he had it, and we Googled all the symptoms. He had taken it, and it was making him a little crazy, and I think he stopped right after that, as far as I can tell. But, you know, we knew it. You know the side effects, like so many things that are bad for you. But this is one story. His experience here, David Stuart McLean, is certainly more extreme than a lot of people's.
We also know the side effects of listening to public radio.
Most certainly.
Intelligence, you become a better conversationalist, you become well-informed, you make new friends by going to events that you heard about on public radio. That actually happens. I've had people call and say, oh, I went to this event that was on your show, and I met these people, and it was fantastic. And blah, blah, blah. So it's, I mean, there's a lot of really good side
effects. And
it
really can be life-changing. Not to be too dramatic, but I mean, one of the shows that I did sitting in for you, Mary Charlotte, was talking about human rights. And I heard a story afterwards. One of the people who told an oral history about his African-American grandmother, he received a call afterwards. There was a woman who literally was near taking her life and heard this person's story and said, I realize that a lot of people have struggles and we can overcome them. I mean, it was so powerful. That was because of this show here in Santa Fe, supporting people. Call 428-1393. If this show has touched you in any way, if it has inspired you and made your day, if it has, you know, helped you meet your life partner at some collected or book event, call.
Or helped you just buy a book that you then read and took home. Mm-hmm. And books are our own kinds of little friends. You know,
absolutely.
You fall in love with books as you do with people, and books don't break your heart, usually.
I would argue with that, but yes, right.
428-1393. We're going to go back to David Stuart McLean. We'll be back. Now, please make that call during this next segment, and let's push us over, hopefully way over, the $1,000 mark. 428-1393.
So now it's more than a decade later. What was the process like of writing this book? And were you kind of working on it all along, or did you start that much later?
I think I was working on it without being aware I was working on it for a long time. I would write stories where people had lost gaps of time, either through prison or through drug use or through bad relationships. I wrote a lot of stories that sort of dealt with missing time in a person's life. And it wasn't until, like, I was finishing up my PhD that I was like, oh, I'm not writing the thing that I'm supposed to be writing. I'm writing around the thing I'm trying to write about. And it wasn't until I finally had a great therapist that I had a pretty big breakthrough in being able to talk about it. But my first attempts at writing about it were all about being funny and it being like a funny anecdote, this wild ride through India and New Mexico. And I had to peel that away, because like being funny anecdote in some ways is a way of controlling the story and not letting the story get close to hurting you again. When you tell an anecdote, you know exactly how it's going to end. You know all the little bits and you know the audience reaction to it. And in some ways, like, it's a damaging mechanism, because you act like you have control of it, but the emotional heft still sits inside of you, outside of the anecdote. And so I had to learn to strip away the anecdote. I had to learn to strip away the need for me to be charming, for me to be liked, for me to think I was smart, for me to any of this stuff, and instead just write the truth of the experience.
Well, it's extraordinary writing on multiple levels. It's, first of all, very honest. There's no self-pity that I could detect. nor do you hide things about yourself that are maybe not so beautiful or that other people might want to hide. And it's also just really beautifully written. The way you use language and similes gives the person reading it. I mean, by the end of the day that I spent reading this book, I felt like I'd been crazy myself and I'd lost my memory myself. I mean, it brought me kind of viscerally into the experience. And I would imagine that writing it, you would have had to be strong enough to re-experience that yourself.
Yeah, when I was writing this, I had a little office above a 7-Eleven, and there was no windows in this office. It was about the size of an overfed broom closet. And so I would go and I would sit there for 8 to 12 hours a day and just try to write and rewrite this thing again and again. I wrote the first 50 pages 9 times until I got to a place where I felt like I could proceed and I had found the right tone and the right way to move forward.
Well, the work definitely paid off. It's a wonderful book. I hope that a lot of people actually read it. You also had a piece on This American Life about it, which I suspect a lot of people heard. Did you get a lot of feedback from that?
Yeah, I got a lot of feedback from people both who had a lot of experience with mefloquine and similar experiences. And one of the terrifying things about telling my story is finding out how lucky I was. So many people have committed suicide on this drug. So many people are hobbled by this drug. The FDA just this last July said that some of its physical side effects might become permanent. And so people will have permanent vertigo and permanent tinnitus and permanent vestibular issues for the rest of their lives. And that's terrifying.
It's also terrifying that there has been so little outcry about the drug, or relatively little outcry. One of the horrifying uses of this drug is the way it was used on prisoners in Guantanamo.
Yeah, that was, it's being called pharmaceutical waterboarding. And it was found during a discovery for this lawyer, Seton Hall professor, who was doing a discovery for one of his clients. And there was this sudden uptick in suicides at Guantanamo. And so, you know, the government dumped data onto this guy during the discovery phase of the trial. And he started finding out these prisoners, upon arriving at Guantanamo, before they'd even been tested for malaria, were given a dose 5 times the normal dose of mefloquine, malarium. And Cuba doesn't have malaria. None of the soldiers who were working at Guantanamo were taking mefloquine, malarium, and none of the contractors were either. So it's being posited that what people were looking for were the side effects to sort of disorient and confuse and make the prisoners paranoid and then more pliable to being able to be interrogated, which is terrifying.
Yeah, and I mean, think about the long-term mental and physical consequences of this drug that you describe in your book. 5 times that normal dose on people who have not been convicted of any crime, who were prisoners, is, there's no words for it. It's unbelievable.
Like, it was a horror show, and I was surrounded by people who wanted good things for me, right?
Right.
It was a really life-changing, horrible experience for me, and, like, everyone around me wanted me to get better. I can't imagine how awful it is for those prisoners. It's one of the terrifying things about this book, and the sort of DOD, Department of Defense, on one hand denying its soldiers that anything was wrong with mefloquine and it kept prescribing mefloquine, and on the other hand force feeding it to prisoners for the side effects that they denied were there. It's incredible.
So how are you after 12 years? Do you feel that there are still effects of this drug in your system, in your brain?
There are things that are there that had never been there before. I still have insomnia. I have panic attacks. I have depression. And none of that was there before.
David Stewart McLean is author of the book, The Answer to the Riddle Is Me, A Memoir of Amnesia. And once again, he will be at Collected Works Bookstore tonight at 6 o'clock right here in Santa Fe, signing copies of the book. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And we are back in the Santa Fe Baking Company. And if you like what you hear, give us a call, 428-1393. And I think we're doing pretty well. I'm not going to give you a number until the end of the show.
And for those out-of-town callers, 866-907-5737. You know that every single morning you turn on the radio, there will be something incredibly interesting, incredibly engaging, and something very often about your community or certainly about this country that impacts you or can feed your imagination, your creativity, your... and your life generally.
428-1393. And I have to say, I get frustrated sometimes because I sometimes just get really tired and I get really overwhelmed and there's too many emails and I've got piles of books and how am I going to even decide which ones to put on the air, much less read them? And then a book like this comes along. And it's like every worry or frustration that I have melts away because the incredible privilege of being able to bring this book to the listeners is just what life is all about.
And again, not just the way it's written that is just so engaging and fun. And like I say, for me to sit down and read a book in 3 hours, I can't even tell you the last time that happened, especially with a six-year-old child. But knowing and hearing about this, who is sitting here reading his own book, Calvin and Hobbes, so he may be the next radio host, watch out. But until then, call 428-1393, because it's not only this book. I mean, Mary Charlotte, so many of the interviews you've done have just been extraordinary. And I think that so many Santa Feans recognize the resource they have in you here. You are not just kind of spectacular in Santa Fe, but really nationwide. The interviews that you do are so exceptional. Your knowledge, your questioning. And if people don't recognize that, they should listen to some of the other people out there, because I assure you, you've got something really, really unique here at KSFR in Mary Charlotte. 428-1393, you have a little bit more time to really express your love and support for her and for KSFR, and certainly for this book.
And we want to get another $200 by the end of this show. That's 4 minutes away, 428-1393. I think the phones are actually quiet now.
Oh, no.
So that means that there is, you know, we've created a space.
Quick,
and
get
an
on the phone right now. Cell phone, dial up if you still have it. Rotary, 428-1393.
Rotary phones.
Remember those? Aiden will never know what that is. He will never know what a typewriter is. He will.
Well, they have them in the old movie, the old black and white movies.
He saw one at a garage sale. He had no idea what it was. He thought it was very cute and unique. And
there was a young man in the baking company typing last year. On a manual typewriter, putting in the paper and typing, and I asked him, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm writing a short story." I said, "Why are you using a typewriter?" He said, "So I don't get tempted to go online."
Oh, there we go. There we go. Self-control.
St. John's student.
I was going to say, speaking of Aiden, we recently had a malaria scare down in Mexico where he was ill, had those kind of classic symptoms, the high fever and chills, which is a symptom of malaria, sweating all over, amazing night sweats. And I went to the hospital there and the doctor said, "Oh, no, it's dengue fever." And that's the only thing we have. We have no medication for malaria. And I said, "Well, wait a minute, dengue and malaria are different, though, and malaria can be deadly if it gets in your liver." And it was quite a scare, but malaria is huge here. So I think that this book touches on so many things about kind of health precautions that people need to take when they are going abroad and the implications of this medicine and the lack of other medicine.
And also, what is reality? I mean,
yes.
That's the other thing that came from this book for me is... Your reality is based on the functioning of your brain. And when it starts to fall apart, your sense of reality shifts so radically that the very sense of who you are, you don't even have that anymore. We've got 1 minute left. Mary Lynn, can we get a report from the control room? Maybe.
Oh. She's doing it here.
Okay.
And also how we identify, how we create our reality based on other people's perceptions. And so much of that comes in this book.
428-1393. We're doing the very best we can, and I think we're just
oh my guys,
there.
If you haven't had a chance, pick up the phone, 428-1393. You can be the last caller on this show today.
Yay.
And, yay, and we have some thank yous.
Oh, good. Oh.
Nan Brown.
Yay.
Elise Gent.
Thank you.
Roberto Capocchi.
Yay.
Claudio Joseph.
Thank you.
Ellen Morris Bond. I can't remember.
Yes, Ellen Morris Bond.
And it's definitely in honor of you, and there's people on the phone.
Okay.
Oh, excellent.
We'll come
back
after the news. We've got 15 seconds. Zaylee Pollan, co-news director of KSFR, fabulous person. Oh, we're going out in 30 more. Okay, so.
So, also, if you didn't have a chance to donate today, you can do it tomorrow, Friday. We're hoping that will be the last day. You can also call during the news hour, though I'm not supposed to pitch the news hour here, but it's another fabulous, fabulous aspect that KSFR has to serve this community, you, the listeners.
428-1393, and tomorrow morning on the Radio Cafe, you know who we're going to have?
Amy Goodman, you are such a rock star. Mary Charlotte is a rock star.
Okay, now it really is time to go. Zaylee Pollan of KSFR, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.